Pragmatic Collaboration, the S.S. Muller School in Dresden. Historian David Motadel interviewed by Till Schmidt about Nazi German politics and Islam.
At the high of the Second World War in 1941 and 42, the Nazis started viewing Islam as a politically significant force. Why?
There were various reasons. On the one hand, German soldiers found themselves confronted with a Muslim population in many of the territories they occupied as of 1941-42, especially in the Balkans and North Africa, but also in the Crimea and the Caucasus region. At the same time, in late 1941, the military situation deteriorated. The Blitzkrieg strategy had failed in the Soviet Union. German troops came under pressure. For military reasons, Germany was looking around for new allies. The NS regime intensified its effort to mobilize Muslims to fight against their ostensibly common enemies, the British Empire, the Soviet Union, the United States, and the Jews.
How did they do that?
As early as 1941, the Wehrmacht had published a Tornisterschrift on Islam to instruct German soldiers on how to interact with Muslims in occupied territories. The text contained not only practical rules of behavior, but also a brief overview of Islamic history and traditions. It aimed to avoid behavior that would be seen as insulting or indecent by Muslims. On the Eastern Front in the Soviet Union, where Islam had been suppressed by Stalin before the war, the German occupiers reopened Islamic schools, hoping to undermine Soviet rule. They also recruited Islamic clergy from North Africa, the Balkans, and from the so-called Ostgebiete, Eastern territories. German propagandists politicized religious texts such as the Quran and the religious imperatives, such as the concept of jihad, to incite religious violence against the ostensibly common enemies. The Germans aimed to be seen as protectors of Islam.
What role did the military mobilization of Muslims play?
Starting in 1941, the Wehrmacht and SS recruited tens of thousands of Muslim volunteers, Bosnians, Albanians, Tatars, and Muslims from the Caucasus and Central Asia. They were hoping to prevent the loss of even more German blood and to compensate for the losses on the Eastern Front. Muslim soldiers were deployed in all theaters of the war. They fought in Stalingrad, Warsaw, Milan, and they even defended Berlin. Interestingly, the recruits were granted far-ranging freedoms, for instance, in respect of prayer rituals or halal food. Military imams played a special role. They were not only responsible for religious advice and care, but also for the political indoctrination of the recruits.
Why did Muslims join the German forces?
In general, not for religious reasons. Many Muslims were recruited from prisoner of war's camp. Their primary concern was to escape the starvation and the disease that was rampant in the camps. They simply hoped a German uniform would help them to survive the war. Others speculated that with German help, they might be able to liberate their homeland from Soviet rule. In regions where civilians were recruited by Wehrmacht or SS, in the Balkans or Crimea, for instance, many hoped to be able to protect their families against guerrillas and marauding militia.
How did the inclusion of Muslims fit with National Socialist racial policies?
Hitler had repeatedly made derogatory remarks about Indians and Arabs. In practice, however, the NS regime was pragmatic, and non-Jewish Turks, Iranians, and Arabs had been explicitly exempt from all official racial discrimination since the 1930s. The governments in Tehran, Ankara, and Cairo had intervened on their behalf. During the war, the Germans were similarly pragmatic with respect to Muslims from the Balkans as well as Turkish minorities in the Soviet Union. Racism against these Muslim groups nevertheless continued to exist. German policy, as designed by the bureaucracy in Berlin, often had little in common with the reality of the occupied territories. An example, in the first months after the attack on the Soviet Union, SS task force shot thousands of Muslims, especially prisoners of war, mistaking them for Jews because of their circumcision. These led to Reinhard Heydrich, the leader of the SS Reichssicherheitshauptamt, issuing an order enjoining the task forces to be more careful. In the occupied territories, Germans found a religiously and ethnically heterogeneous population that included Muslim, Roma and Jewish converts to Islam. In Sarajevo alone, 20% of the Jewish population converted to Islam or Catholicism between April and October 1941. Others were able to escape dressed as Muslims, using a veil to avoid being recognized, for instance.
Were the Islamic policies successful in view of National Socialist objectives?
While the jihad strategy of in the First World War can be regarded as failure, in the Second World War it at least managed to mobilize tens of thousands of Muslims to join the fight against the Allies. However, German attempts to gain Muslim allies were less successful than anticipated. From 1943 on, the military situation was so hopeless that Muslim soldiers were unable to effect substantial changes in the situation. The enemies of Hitler's Germany, in particular the British Empire and the Soviet Union, were much more successful in recruiting Muslims. Hundreds of thousands fought for the Allies, especially in the British colonial units and de Gaulle's Free French Forces. These Muslim soldiers contributed significantly to the liberation of Europe.
How do you assess the Nazis' ideological involvement of Muslims?
Some of the leading Nazis, Hitler and Himmler in particular, were fascinated by Islam and on a number of occasions openly declared their ideological sympathies. During the war, whenever Hitler criticized the Catholic Church, he presented Islam as a positive counterexample. Whereas he condemned Catholicism as a weak and effeminate religion, he praised Islam as the strong and aggressive religion of warriors. Overall, however, German policies were formed by strategic and pragmatic considerations and not ideological motives. Above all, Islam was the means to an end for the NS regime, and everyone knew it. And yet the lack of ideological underpinnings against Islam and Muslims were a necessary precondition for German policy making.
To what extent was this driven by anti-Semitism?
As with German propaganda directed at foreign countries in general, anti-Semitism was enormously important. It was often linked with disparaging Zionist immigration to Palestine. This type of propaganda was especially directed at Arab regions. But propaganda directed at Muslims and in the Balkans and on the Eastern Front was also charged with anti-Semitism. It was disseminated in the respective local languages using both radio and leaflets. Some of the Nazis' Muslim allies shared their hatred of Jews, especially the Mufti of Jerusalem. In the war zones in the Balkans, North Africa, or the so-called Eastern Territories, the picture was more complex. In many of these regions, Muslims had coexisted with Jews for a long time, and in some cases, Muslims actively helped Jews to hide from the Germans.
In the course of the Second World War, the Waffen-SS developed from an originally ideological and military unit made up exclusively of German soldiers into a multi-ethnic army. Many Muslims fought on the German side during World War II for a variety of reasons. Often, it was a common conception of who the enemy was, or more pragmatic forms of collaboration, that led Muslims to join the Wehrmacht or the SS. Altogether, the Wehrmacht had 6 legions with a Muslim majority, while the SS had 3 divisions, a brigade and a Waffenverband, or mixed unit whose members were for the most part Muslims. The Muslims fighting in the so-called Eastern Legions of the Wehrmacht included Azerbaijanis, Crimean, and Volga Tatars, North Caucasians, Balkans, and Uzbeks. They were recruited mainly from Soviet prisoners of war. Serious war crimes were known to have been committed, at least by the Muslim Bosnian Waffen SS units during the so-called partisan combat in the Balkans. SS headquarters permitted the involvement of imams, the prayer leaders for Islamic prayers, in the individual battalions and promised that Islamic dietary rules would be respected. Compliance with Muslim funeral rites was also granted. As a result, each Muslim unit got a mullah, an Islamic preacher, or clergyman as an advisor. As a rule, however, the Muslim army clergyman had to be trained first. As a result, in November 1944, an SS mullah school was founded in Dresden, especially for Muslims from the area of the USSR. Within the SS, they were organized into an East Turkish and a Caucasian Waffenverband. A villa in Dresden, Lothringerweg 2 in Blasewitz, was rented for the SS Mullah School. It had belonged to Jenny Jacoby, a Jewish citizen of Dresden, before it was confiscated and used as a so-called Judenhaus. Multiple Jewish families had lived there, among them also Victor and Iver Klemperer. Most of them were deported to the concentration camps of Theresienstadt or Auschwitz in 1942 and 1943. Where most of them were murdered. As part of the Islamic redesign of the villa, an entrance hall was designed with imitation mosaics and quotes from the Quran in the style of Central Asian mosques. Another room that was intended to serve as a prayer room received a mihrab, an Islamic prayer niche. Finding Islamic teachers proved to be difficult. Finally, Professor Alm Idris, an employee of the German Foreign Office, was hired as headmaster. However, he could only be in Dresden for 3 days each week, since he was otherwise in Berlin, in charge of propaganda, radio programs for the Soviet and Central Asian regions. Amin el-Husseini, the Nazi collaborationist, Mufti of Jerusalem, was also involved in planning the SS Mullah School in Dresden from the very start. He had convinced the SS Hauptamt that an institution such as this was necessary and was hoping to extend his influence to all Muslims living in the German Reich. On November 26, 1944, he congratulated Himmler on the inauguration of the school with the following telegram. On the occasion of the opening of the Imam Institute of the Eastern Turks in Dresden, another sign of your great interest in Islamic-German cooperation. I would like to express sincere gratitude and best regards on behalf of all Muslims. I assure you that this collaborative work and our common struggle will continue to be closer and greater until achieving final victory. Signed, Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, currently Dresden. SS Gruppenführer Walter Schellenberg also spoke at the inauguration and implored the non-Russian peoples of the Soviet Union to fight Bolshevism side by side with Germany. He called Islam an important bulwark against the national, ethnic, and cultural uprooting of the Eastern Turks. According to the records of the SS Obersturmbannführer Rainer Ocha, scheduled courses included Arabic reading and writing, reading of the Quran, Quranic commentaries, history of Islam, and of the Islamic peoples and Islamic prayer. In a report on his visit of the volunteer Turkish Working and Reserve Brigade, Alam Idris of the Foreign Office described the content of his ideological coursework, which would have been similar to that taught at the SS Mullah School. He says, "In my political lectures, I mainly demonstrated the imperialist politics of England, America, and the Soviet Union, and the Islam-friendly politics of Germany, using examples from history, proved that in case of an Anglo-American Soviet victory, 2 billion Muslims would, without exception, become slaves of 15 million international Jews for many years. Therefore, not only Turkish Muslims, but also the other peoples of Russia, must join with the brave German soldiers to fight with all their energy against the attacks of Jewish Soviet Russia." In total, Idris taught 62 Muslim Soviet prisoners of war in the SS Mullah School in Dresden. 13 students are known to have been slated to remain on at the school as teachers. The Archive for Contemporary History in Munich holds lists of the students enrolled in classes 1 and 2 and their bilingual degree certificates. After the bombing of Dresden on February 13th and 14th, 1945, the school ceased operations. Teachers and students fled to Weissenfeld in Saxony-Anhalt. Their fate after May 1945 is not certain. However, there are indications that a number of Muslim soldiers avoided extradition to the Soviet Union and settled in southern Germany. The impact of the anti-Semitic propaganda of the SS Müller School in Dresden has to be considered as relatively small, if for no other reason than its relatively short existence. The Arabic-language shortwave radio broadcasts in the village of Seesen, south of Berlin, for example, were a much more effective propaganda tool. The National Socialists inherited the broadcasting infrastructure in Seesen from the previous government. It became one of many National Socialist propaganda tools for targeting foreign countries. Political scientist and historian Matthias Kunzel writes, "It broadcast a daily Arabic language program to the Middle East since 1939. No other station enjoyed a greater degree of popularity than this Nazi station broadcast from Seesen between 1939 and 1945. Here, anti-Semitic tirades were interspersed with quotes from the Quran and Arab music. Program highlights at the Radio Seesen included the calls to jihad by the, at the time, most popular figure in the Arab Islamic world, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, who lived in Berlin between 1941 and 1945. Nobody promoted hatred of the Jews among Muslims more successfully than him and influenced the early history of the Middle East conflict at the same time. Heinrich Himmler, enthused about the ideological bond between National Socialism and Islam, he also introduced the term Musul German, and al-Husseini pointed out the ideological similarities between Muslims and Germans. These were said to include obedience and discipline, the will to battle, and the honor of falling in battle. Community, family, and offspring, glorification of labor and creating, and relations to the Jews. The Mufti declared, "In fighting Judaism, Islam and the Nazis are coming very close to one another." The collaboration of Muslim Soviet prisoners of war with the National Socialists does, however, raise questions with regard to the political and personal motives of the SS Müller students in Dresden. Because of the lack of definitive historical sources, we can only speculate about their reasons to switch to the German side, just as the history of the SS Müller School can only be reconstructed from documents and interviews given by German SS members. The definition of volunteer is of crucial importance here. Considering the conditions in German prisoners of war camps, a purely voluntary decision simply cannot be assumed. Historian André Angrick calls these recruitments selection to live, but at the price of collaboration and armed support. The head of the SS Hauptamt, Gottlieb Berger, emphasized how racist and purely functional his view of the soldiers was. "If they fail, we shoot them. Very simple." The most comprehensive discussion of this issue is by the historian Patrick von Zermühlen, who concludes that personal motives are more important than political ones. Although the national committees of the Soviet volunteers on the German side viewed the legions as national armies of liberation, the lack of historical evidence makes it unclear if the legionnaires shared their view. In the case of political motives, von Zermühlen believes that nationalism was more important than anti-communism. He addresses desertions to partisans or back to the Red Army. Especially in the Caucasus, multiple units deserted to the Soviet side, either because of homesickness or in order not to fight against their compatriots. The desertions back to the Red Army increased as the German defeat became more and more apparent. The role of any ideological overlap with the National Socialists remains unclear. It is impossible to reconstruct how widespread anti-Semitism and extermination ideology were amongst the SS military mullahs. Existing sources only confirm pragmatic collaboration. The crimes committed by Germans against Soviet prisoners of war made collaboration a means of survival. The price for this, however, is complicity in the criminal National Socialist system.